the issue came up because in the worry about the environment right now, that there's a lot of discussion about whether Christianity is in some way responsible for the problem we've got ourselves into. And so I as a historian, have been looking at what not only what Christians thought about nature and the environment, but how they experienced it for the first 18 centuries, and then what happened in the late 18th and the 19th century to change Christian attitudes towards nature. Now, I'm not going to do the whole week on that because I'm a Luther scholar by training, and I've written a number of books on Martin Luther. And on Wednesday, we're celebrating the Renaissance, so I'm going to do something on Luther and the Renaissance on Wednesday. And then on Saturday, I'm going to take the theme of this year's Holden Village theme, which is water washed, spirit born, and talk about Luther and baptism. But in between that, I'm going to look at a number of different topics. And today and tomorrow are kind of the sad topics. I'm going to look at the issue of dominion, and tomorrow procreation and contraception. And they're both related to a very famous verse in Genesis. Genesis 1:28. It's probably hard for you to read, but does anyone from memory can recite this verse? No. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." It is this text that has often been invoked by various folks in discussions about the environment and what we're supposed to do with the environment. Let me just stop here and ask, have any of you heard anyone say this thing about having dominion and use it in the environmental discussions? Yeah.
Well, in Latin, is it not dominion means steward? Is that maybe true?
Yeah, that's
stewards instead of dominating and controlling. It's right. Actually, live in harmony with.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're getting to my conclusion before I before we deal with some of the setup here.
It's a difficult subject to bring up in an adult's forum at church because this verse, this passage, it's very difficult to break the ice or to talk about the environment.
Mm-hmm. There's actually three parts to this verse that are important. One is God blessed them, and God said to them. So this is a blessing, not a commandment. So that's the first thing. Then the second one, which we're going to deal with tomorrow, is be fruitful and multiply. Be fruitful and multiply. Procreate. Have babies. And then, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And then and subdue it and have dominion over it. We had a couple of secretaries of state. Everyone remember James Watt? What did he have to say about dominion, do you recall?
It's a responsibility to use stuff up before the second coming.
Yeah. He said that it was irresponsible of us not to use up the natural resources as quickly as possible, because when the second coming occurred, God would expect us to make account for what he'd given us, or God had given us. James Watt said he used me for God. And that anything that we hadn't used up, God would be angry about. An interesting notion. One of his fellow followed after him, Manuel Lujan, under Bush. You recall what he said? He took this classic notion. He said, we're commanded to have dominion over it and subdue it, and we should, that means that all the rest of nature is there for our use. Now, before we, you know, sort of
get,
feel superior to these poor benighted secretaries of
Interior,
Secretary of the Interior. There was a piece a couple years ago where a bunch of Norwegian pastors, I saw your Norway shirt, Norwegian pastors sent an open letter to the United States, to the pastors of the United States, these are Lutherans, saying, how is it that you're giving us a hard time about our whaling practices? Because after all, we have dominion over the fish of the sea. And that means we should. And people look at this and say, you know, Christianity is at the root of this problem because it has this wrong idea. So what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about dominion. And I, as a historian, when I think about issues, I like to ask the question, well, what did this mean in history? It's clear that for some people today, it means clear-cutting. We have the right to clear-cut, we have the right to fish species to extinction. Or, if that's too strong, at least that we're sort of we're anthropocentric. We say that human beings come first. We should be able to do what we want to do because God has made us this way and has given us dominion over this, and so everything there exists for our benefit. Maybe it's something you'll hear. And you'll hear it in high places, but you'll also hear it among ordinary people. The whole spotted owl controversy, any of you from Oregon?
Yes.
That issue comes up, right, buddy?
No, all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to define what the long-term benefit for humanity is. Is it to use up the old-growth timber today, or to let our great-grandchildren be exposed to it also? So what is our best interest?
You know, I should put my card on the table and say I'm a strong environmentalist. So, but as a historian, I was kind of, and as a Christian, I was put in a very awkward position because I saw all these other Christians using the Bible in this particular way. And not well as a historian. Let me go back and take a look at how this was understood in the past. There were a couple things that bothered me about it. Let me share some things. In the Roman Empire, when Christianity, you know, spread out of the Middle East and became first a minority religion and then the dominant religion in the empire, the life expectancy of most people was under 30 years. That is, people certainly did live into their 50s and 60s, but the life expectancy on average was about 28, 29 years. About a third of the population died in their first year, of life. And those statistics, though they may have varied a little bit from century to century, were true well into the early modern period. It's a period when Martin Luther showed up around 1600. Actually, it went longer than that in large parts of Europe. So if probably most people, most families, half of the children will die in child, within their first year to 5 years. Raises the question, what does dominion mean? In a situation in which 95% of the population lived from agriculture, they were all farmers, directly or indirectly. Any of you farmers?
Background.
Yeah. Rain at the wrong time is no blessing. Insects can come in and devastate. One hailstorm can take it out, and then you can have starvation. Just when you know that, the thought that dominion, what does dominion mean in the case where most people feel very much out of control in what's going on rather than in control? Let's do a little experiment. I want you to each sort of in your mind think of three adjectives for God, or three words to describe God. Think of the sort of the three best words for God that you can come up with. You know, like loving or whatever. Think about that for a second. Okay, let's see what you come up with. Who wants
provider.
To help? What?
Provider.
Provider? Just shout them out.
Hidden.
Hidden.
Omniscient.
What?
Omniscient.
Omniscient, yeah.
Creative.
Suffering.
Compassionate.
Forgiving. What?
You said we couldn't.
Caring.
And we can't use the loving.
Sure, loving.
Powerful.
Universal.
Other things that
omniscient.
Have, omniscient. Others that we haven't mentioned?
Infinite.
Anything else? You happy, suppose?
Spirit.
What?
Almighty.
Redeeming.
But you could even say he's a caregiver.
Caregiver?
In today's vernacular.
Just.
Well, if you'd asked this question at any time before, say, 1800, certainly in the medieval and ancient world, there's a word that would have come up. Bunny's got it. Can I say it loudly, Bunny?
Angry.
Wrathful. Mm-hmm. Why is it that they would have thought of wrathful and we don't? Well, is there any evidence in the Bible that he's wrathful? God's wrathful?
They didn't understand science like we think we do, so all unfortunate occurrences were God's doing.
Uh-huh. What's your name?
Joyce.
Joyce has got it. Wrathful. There's lots of words in the Bible where God is spoken of as angry. God repents of God's anger at certain places. But and it's not just in the Hebrew Scripture. There are parts of the New Testament where God is not happy. So there's plenty of evidence. Why is it that when we read the Scripture, we don't come up with it? Well, Joyce had.
We've got an explanation.
We have an explanation for a lot of things. Used to be that God was blamed for things that now we can explain with science, but there's more to it than that. It's once again the mortality statistics that I gave you, that most people felt that they were very much, as in Jonathan Edwards' words, sinners in the hands of an angry God. So many horrible things happened to them. And a lot of them, since most of the people lived in the countryside, had to raise their own food. Many of those horrible things were directly related to nature. It was disease, starvation, either a bountiful harvest or a scant harvest. And when they tried to explain why was this happening, they had a ready explanation. God was angry. So, wrathful, angry. When we talk about dominion now, what do we normally mean?
Control.
We're in charge. But when Christians in the 1st century, or the 4th century, or the 14th century, or even the 17th century, most of them, when they looked around at the world, the last thing they thought was that they were in control. Instead, they came up with other explanations. What do you think, the mention here of stewardship. We'll talk more about stewardship, and it's a fascinating idea. On Thursday, we deal with St. Francis. And St. Francis develops a notion of stewardship, which is very alien to modern sensibilities. But for most of them, when they talk about dominion, they dealt with it a little bit differently. They didn't think of stewardship, because stewardship also implies control in some sense. You're stewards over things. Any thought about what they would do with it? If their reality, the world that they were experiencing, was anything but control, what explanation could they come up with for this verse?
They were to fight against it. I mean, when you talk about subdue it, you go back, line, they would, to try and subdue it, they would just try and fight it. Mm-hmm. So that these natural consequences wouldn't keep piling on top of it.
Yeah, but they lost the fight, 9 out of 10 times.
Right.
Well, first, I'll just say this parenthetically. They weren't interested in this line very much. The one they spent all their time thinking about was not have dominion. It was be fruitful and multiply. And that's what we'll deal with tomorrow. So one is simply, and we do that ourselves, selective attention. To have dominion didn't make sense, so they didn't spend a lot of time trying to figure it out. But be fruitful and multiply, they understood that. Although the world, especially after the collapse of the Roman Empire, the world that they were filling was pretty empty, and the filling was pretty hard. But they did still talk about dominion, and there are two ways in which they handled it. Can we do any creative people here? How would you, if you couldn't avoid it, it clearly wasn't happening, what is there in the Christian story that would allow you to deal with this?
It's the hope of salvation.
Hmm?
You look forward to the afterlife.
Yeah. That's one way to deal with it. Well, what they did is they said, yeah, we once had dominion, but in the fall we lost it. That was one. In the fall we lost it. So that was one way of dealing with it. Human beings once had dominion. And dominion was a form of stewardship. It was not you used it up for your benefit. Instead, that before the fall, you were sort of like helping to cultivate the garden. In fact, in Genesis, when you talk about Adam, the word comes from cultivated soil. So when you were had dominion over what you were, is that you were acting in God's stead, but God didn't make things to be used up. God made the world for itself and to be enjoyed, and you, as a human being, were supposed to. And that in Eden, before the fall, that's the way human beings behave. And when we talk about Francis on Thursday, those of you who decide you still want to come at that point, many people saw Francis as the third Adam. And there's the first Adam. Who's the second Adam?
Jesus.
And Francis was the way the human being should be had there not been a fall. So that's one of the things. The other thing they did, and this one would have been harder for you to guess, is that they allegorized it. They made it an allegory. Any of you read Cloister Walk by Kathleen Norris?
You started.
Well, I recommend it to those of you who haven't. Kathleen Norris, mm-hmm. She's a poet, Presbyterian, who is a Benedictine oblate,
and she wrote Dakota. Some of you may have heard of Dakota. And now she has a new book, which is all over the place. It's something of a bestseller called Cloister Walk, in which she, among other things, deals with, she talks about how Benedictine life helps her develop her own spiritual sensibilities. And she does talk about the early fathers and the desert fathers. And one of the things that the early fathers did with things that they couldn't understand directly is they turned it into an allegory. Now, if you're going to find an allegory of dominion, what would it be? Any idea? I'll give you a big hint with the desert fathers. Do you know who the desert fathers are? Anyone know? These are folks that went off, monks, and then groups of monks who left the cities of Egypt, first lived in the suburbs, and then when they became too popular there, they moved out into the desert. That's really the origin of monasticism, especially the more rigorous stuff.
So dominion would be to master yourself.
That's right. So, dominion. It's self-mastery. Or, because it's an allegory, the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and every living thing are symbols of the animal passions of the human being. So, you know, we talk about he was angry as a bear and so on. They literally assumed that since you couldn't control the outside world, maybe you could control yourself. And this was an allegory about controlling the passions. Big pardon? And they withdrew to do that. They withdrew into nature. They saw nature as very alive and real. They also saw nature sometimes as threatening. But mainly, they dealt with subduing their own passions. So, what you find, if you look at this, the history of this text, for 18 centuries, you will hardly find a Christian theologian or a Jewish rabbi who understands this have dominion as meaning exploiting the natural world. Almost none for 18 centuries. Doesn't mean there aren't, you can find maybe one or two that sort of, you find a couple that say, well, yeah, that's how you get domesticated animals. You know, that there you have sort of a little bit of what originally was intended. But basically, for 18 centuries, no one understood it the way James Watt or Manuel Lujan or the Norwegian pastors understood dominion. Now, you might rightly ask, so what?
Mark?
Yeah?
When this was written, we obviously don't know, who wrote this, but it was oral tradition that was handed down for a long time, and then it was written in the Torah. And does anybody have any, thought about what, when this was originally written, what was the thought back then? The same kind of thing, or?
Well, as I said, before I say anything, do we have an Old Testament scholar in the house to whom I should defer? I don't. Most of the commentators on it emphasize the theme of blessing. And a blessing is different than a commandment. And then the rabbis from the second century on, and Christian theologians, each in their own way, argue about, is this a commandment or is this a blessing? And if it's a commandment, what does it mean? And most of them concentrate on the be fruitful part of it. What did it originally mean? I don't know if there was a single answer. answer to that.
I mean, it must have been important enough that it was carried on for this long period of time before actually being written down.
Right.
And, you know, it didn't get dropped.
Yeah, well, the first chapter of Genesis comes out of one tradition, and the second chapter is another. And it's actually fairly late in the composition of the Hebrew Bible, even though it's the first book of the Bible, it's put together at a later point. And I'm almost exhausted. I need your wife here to help us out. All I can say, and this I do know, is that when we look at the early Christian fathers, which would be the patristics, and what they have to say about this, and we look at the rabbis, Christianity and Judaism, as they currently exist, both developed at the same time. I mean, we think about Judaism being earlier, but the fact of the matter is that the form of Judaism we have today, rabbinic Judaism, is a product of the second century, just as Christianity, in its major form, is also a product of the second century. And both the rabbis, the commentators on the Torah, and the Christians, when they dealt with this, they were particularly interested in this blessing and to be fruitful and multiply. And the big issue that they really worry about is what you might call the issue of the chosen people. Because both the rabbinic Jews and the early Christians saw themselves as the chosen people. The trouble was, Genesis doesn't refer just to the Jews or the Christians. It's a blessing on all of humanity.
When I would have looked at that in a very naive, simplistic form, I would have thought this was addressed to nomadic people. Dominion would have been, you catch what you need, catch and kill in order to survive, and you keep your cattle and your goats under control until you get to the promised land.
Mm-hmm.
I don't read into it all this other deep stuff.
Yeah, well, I think, Judy, that's a good segue into the question of what do we do with it now. What I've laid out is that for 18 centuries, when you looked at what theologians and rabbis did, they didn't understand it the way we do today, or some do today. I tried to give you some of the reasons why they don't. They didn't experience dominion. The change occurs with the rise of science. And in fact, it's very much connected to the rise of science and technology. Some of the very first and strongest statements about dominion in a sort of secular context comes from Bacon in the 17th century. And it becomes sort of popularized in the early 19th century. So the view that dominion means you're in charge of the rest of nature and it's there for your benefit is literally just about 200 years old. It's a popular notion. Can we in any way recover some of these earlier ideas? Is either of the ideas at all useful, given that we do have so much more power now than we used to? Yeah.
Well, as long as the Lutheran Church is so wrapped up in sin and redemption, there's not room for the environment and original blessing to come in, unless there's some sort of revolution or some sort of awareness. And so I don't see it ever happening. It's just going to continue until we're all like run out of resources or something, where the youth form a new vision. But most people have grown up in sin and redemption is what religion is about, and this environment thing is for the government to solve or something. I don't know. It's really at a deadlock right now for churches to think about being environmentally aware. Is kind of a delicate subject. Mm-hmm. You can use stop using styrofoam cups, and that's about as far as it goes.
Do you ever hear in your churches someone talk about dominion in sort of the James Watt way? No. I think the point.
We often talk about our sin of using the environment.
Right.
You know, in the sin and redemption model, that's one of the sins that we bring up a lot. Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be important.
Let's take a look at this thing again. If we assume that it's a blessing, is there something in this? Let's skip the be fruitful and multiply for a minute. You mentioned earlier the dominionist notion of stewardship. Is there any promise in that? Do you think any way out of our dilemma with that?
Yeah, we could emphasize that word more than dominion and learn more of the difference in what those two directions would be. Maybe people would start saying, yeah, I'm going to embrace the environment more openly, and it's not a bad topic to talk about. But it seems like, boy, it just breaks kind of the normal thing right now. Goes against the grain. Matthew Fox is so associated with that, and was bring up the word, you know, his name in a forum or discussion at a church, and it's like, you know, you might as well get out of there. I don't want to hear his name. Seems like I just get a little frustrated. He's got a lot of embracing the environment, and it's okay. The spirituality is an okay thing. It's not an evil thing to think that we're part of the environment and that rocks and trees might have some right to be here and exist, and maybe they have a spirit. That's okay.
What's your name?
George.
George. Someone have something to say to George? I mean, George has raised some very important...
I always have to link this and read it in terms of the story of the fall, too, and the kind of relationship that seems to have existed in the garden, in the concept of the writers, that human beings are there as part of the creation to enjoy, to fellowship with God, to care for, to help care for. And it is in that story, after the eating of the apple or whatever fruit it was, that they're sent out to grub in the ground and survive. Mm-hmm. And I grew up on former Nez Perce Indian Reservation country, and very early in my life got touched by some of that native spirituality at its best, I think, in terms of the earth as the mother supporting, and we're here as a part of that. But I've never seen that inconsistent with Christianity and the teachings of Christ. And so I'm all wrapped up in that. And so when the environmental movement started, I feel very much at home in the midst of that concern as a Christian. But I realize there are others who interpret that passage in a very destructive way.
You know, part of the point of my saying that for 18 centuries Christians thought of this one way, and for two centuries, I'm simplifying now, but approximately two, they've thought another, is to point out that in fact Christians do change their minds on passages and issues. Now, I happen to have trouble with Matthew Fox, not because of what he holds out, but because he's a very bad historian of the period.
But it could well be that just as 200 or so years ago, some of these ideas were changed because of what science and technology allowed us, showed us. It may now be that we're at another one of those cusps where our attitude is going to change and we're going to be picking up on other themes within the scripture, because in this case it's not so much, well, it is science and technology in part, is saying if we keep doing what we're doing, we're going to destroy ourselves and everything and ruin a lot of other things. I mean, the world will keep going on without us. But we could do a lot of damage before lights are out for us. So there's in fact a change. There's been a change once before, around between 1700 and 1800. And then we may be at the beginning of another change where we go back to some other notions. The notion of the steward, what does that invoke in your mind? Is that even a word that means much today? We have stewardesses. We don't call them that now. They're flight attendants because we have both men and women. But it's not a word that we use much.
I never think of that as the same as stewardship, the stewards I play. I mean, I've never even thought of it so much. But stewardship, we heard about always.
Mm-hmm. And what has...
I, that word is more in tune than dominion. I don't... Harking back to... Yes, caregiver. Harking back even to confirmation, we hear about stewardship.
Caretaker of that which belongs to another. And you preserving, perpetuating, developing, maintaining long term.
That's absolutely crucial. Caretaker of something which belongs to another. If we have the time, we could go out and look at these, what goes on before and after this. And there are rabbis and theologians that say that this blessing is for all of what God has created up to this point. And then God speaks. There's some question about, you know, who receives the blessing. But there's no doubt that, as it was most likely understood in the early period, and was even, as we'll see when we look at St. Francis, stewardship was a stewardship over something that did not belong to you. You know, your good and faithful servant. The story of the talents. Someone tell that story for the, what happens?
Didn't take good care of it. You were lose what you were given.
Right. The notion that you were given charge over something else in which you were supposed to make sure that it flourished. There is a whole group of Hebrew Bible scholars who now, looking back at this whole story, have caught up, for example, the notion that the word for dominion is really the word for stewardship. And when they talk about the earth, it's really the cultivated soil. And that after all, it was being written, as you said earlier, not for nomadic, actually. They were, at this point, involved in agriculture. They had some herding, and then they had their own fields, and it had a different message. Yes, it's great.
Well, didn't dominion in the Middle Era, at the time that it was translated into English, also was sort of dealing with the rights of kings? I mean, a king had this kingly right, but there was also, in the true sense of the word, there was also a kingly responsibility. Mm-hmm. And that you have absolute right to control the country, but you also have the absolute responsibility to take care of the country and the people who are in it. And so I can see how that term could be used as sort of the same as stewardship. And I don't know what the Greek word or the Hebrew word was, but mm-hmm. You know, when it was translated into English, you know, at the time of the King James Version, that was the sense of what a king did, was have dominion, and it involved the responsibility.
Right. It in fact, had the whole, it was an interrelated, it went both ways. And we'll see this when we're dealing with Francis. We have a notion of power and control, which is one way. I control this. Dominion in the late 16th, early 17th century, when the King James was written, the word dominion did have a notion of reciprocal responsibilities. The king had certain responsibilities. I mean, people had responsibilities vis-a-vis the king, but the king in turn had certain responsibilities vis-a-vis the people. And we'll see with Francis how that is worked out in a fascinating way. So dominion. What we may, to summarize, what we may be at now is a point where the two centuries that we've gone through is the aberration, you know, the weird out of joint period, and we're going back to a different understanding, an understanding that has more to do with stewardship of something that doesn't belong to you. Belongs to someone else. Any thoughts about this?
How do scholars in other areas of the world that do not have as much control over the environment as we do in Western cultures look at these? Are there African scholars would look at this much differently than we would?
You mean African Christians?
An African Christian in Ethiopia or something like that would look at this much differently than we would.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer. I do know that when you look at other of the world religions, they've all done the same thing when science and technologies come in. Whatever the religion, I mean, you take certain forms of Buddhism or Confucian, I mean, they've all changed under the impact of technology and science. So it may be a sad commentary, but religion often changes according to what is happening in the larger world.
You asked about this notion, whether we could return to this notion of stewardship of things that do not belong to us. Mm-hmm. And I think we have such a strong sense of private property in our culture that seems to be almost a prohibitive challenge for us to begin to look at the land that we're living on as not something that we own.
What do you think of that?
It took us 18 centuries to get control of it. It's hard to change that approach in 2 centuries. Mm-hmm. It took a long time to build a life expectancy up to 70 years. Mm-hmm. And part of that, I think, is, you know, we finally got control. I don't want to.
Right.
If I give it up, then we're going to go back to that old way.
Other thoughts about this? And this, Maury has brought up, I think, a serious, serious problem.
Well, I just kind of thought about this as far as copyright laws go and how other parts of the world, other countries of the world view our copyright laws. And it's everybody's. And China can duplicate as much as they want, and they just think it's free for the taking. And perhaps in the next generation or so, that concept will enter into how we view and other kinds of properties. I don't know.
Yeah, intellectual property.
World order grows and become one.
Yeah, but the trouble is intellectual property, which I think is a form of property, it certainly has legal. And the whole argument that knowledge is the most important capital asset that one is going to have in the next century, trained intelligence. But it's unlike other property, it's something that you can give away and still it won't diminish your store at all. if anything, in the process of teaching it that is giving it away, you're likely to appreciate knowledge. It's unlike most property, but private property like land, there's a whole movement, the property rights movement in this country that has made some advances to say that if you deprive them of their property by, for example, environmental regulations, the government has to pay for what losses occurred. Run into that? It sounds fair, except it probably means that you can't pass any environment regulations because you couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm. It raises all kinds of questions related to the whole process of inheritances that are passed on.
Yeah.
Why should someone who had the right time in history when you could grab up vast portions of the land and soon it was called yours, be able to pass that on forever to your descendants, and somebody who was born a decade later who didn't have those opportunities is left without the possibility of ownership? What kind of justice is that?
Do you know where the modern notion of property has its origin? England, yeah, I know, for our country, England. You know when?
The 1500s, I think.
Yeah, it's the early modern period. The modern notion of private property is about somewhere around 400, 500 years old. It's a new invention, too. Let's say arbitrarily, it's around 1500. And you could argue about when it starts and when the lawyers start to get it together and what are its antecedents. But it's a notion that's pretty new. And the notion of complete ownership is a lot more recent than that. In fact, throughout most of our history, the ownership of private property, right down to the present day, has never been thought to be absolute. You know, there's things like eminent domain, where for the good of a larger society, you can take. And it was written into the Constitution that property should not be taken away without due compensation. That's why they say it's a form of illegal taking to put on environmental regulations that restrict what a person could do. And yet zoning laws have been around for a long time. And never before was it claimed that zoning was somehow an illegal taking.
Yeah, but there are people that are claiming that now.
I know, they are. Yeah. They are now. But it's a new idea.
We should look at the Jewish custom too of the Jubilee, which we did here a couple weeks ago at Holden, which runs counter to all of this, of course, with the redistribution of the land.
How do you spell Jubilee?
Jubilee.
I'm not a very good speller.
Which was an every 50-year event, which at the time of the Jewish people, of course, that was two or three generations. So you redistributed all the property and made things equal again.
In theory.
I was having a thought a little bit before this, and I hate to interject, but there, through some upheavals, I mean, every few years there is some kind of redistributions, you know, through a political movement, wars, and new technologies and things like that. You know, so this idea that this inheritance goes on, I mean, there are examples of that have gone on for hundreds and hundreds of years, but I think that there's a big examples that show that there's other forces working here too. Mm-hmm.
I think I said Jubilee is in theory because very early on, the Jubilee was quite impractical. Because as you started to approach the Jubilee year, people would be unable or unwilling to invest in their land and what have you. And so they developed ways of getting around the Jubilee quite early on. They would give the land for a day to a foreigner who was not subject to the Jubilee and then for a payment, and then the foreigner would give it back again. And the 50 years started up over again. And there were various other ways that they got around it. I mean, it's a great idea. The trouble is that even in the, you know, in the period, you know, 500, 600 before Christ, and we're already getting around the Jubilee because it didn't work. It didn't work. I mean, it's hard to run a society that way. I mean, I like the idea, but it's hard to run a society that way.
One of the points you haven't touched on is the attitude taken by some third world people that, you know, we've exploited ours. We've gotten what we need out of the world, and they'd like the opportunity, but now we're trying to restrict their opportunities.
Yeah, the point is being made by various folks that the only way we can keep them from doing what we did is if we're willing to share our goodies with them now, which we don't seem to be willing to do. That is, share the fruits of our prosperity with others, or else they can say, we'll go ahead and do it ourselves. You take, for example, CO2 emissions. If we shut down all of our ways in which we emit CO2, like power plants and the like, and made a drastic reduction in car emissions, it would do no good at all because the number of coal-fired plants being built in China will more than take up the slack. Of course, if we keep doing what we're doing, it only gets worse. But there, stewardship. There's another objection to the notion of stewardship as dominion. There's the private property one, which is an issue that with this notion of illegal takings and so on is a very difficult one. But there's another one, and that is stewardship that some people say, well, none of these things work. Big word for it is anthropocentric, which is just a fancy. This is, you see, professors come up with big words like that and they can justify their salaries. But all it means is it's too human-centered. Some will say it's anthropocentric, which is too male human-centered. But that stewardship once again puts us in the driver's seat and sort of establishes a hierarchy where it makes us superior to other parts of the biotic community and the non-biotic community. What do you think of that? Did you understand the argument? I should tell you when I'm done, I'm going to give you a number of books that you can read if you want to study any of these things further. Does that bother anyone here?
Well, would you please explain the alternative to the anthropocentric way of life or theory? What's the alternative?
Well, I'm a bad one to explain it since I don't accept this objection, but...
Would it help if I told you your time is up?
Oh, save by the bell.
I have 2 minutes at least.
Okay.
The argument is that if you could use one of them is a rights approach, where you assign rights to, you know, to trees and to animals and so on, and then you could adjudicate on rights. But then they get into trouble of who, you know, does an insect have the same right as a beaver? Does that have the same right? And they go. There are various attempts, though, to get at it. I think in conclusion, I mean, it's not the last word at all, but on this one is that like it or not, we are in charge to a certain degree. And so we need to learn how to exercise that responsibly. There are books on this. On stewardship, for instance, there's a book by Hall.
What's his
Douglas
name?
John.
Douglas John. It's either John Douglas or Douglas John. It's Douglas John Hall on stewardship, which I'd recommend to you if you're interested.
If you are interested in studying this whole business about Dominion and its history, there's a work by a man named Cohen called Be Fruitful and Multiply, which is on this text. Let's see, what's his first name, since there's lots of Cohens out there. Jeremy, he's at Ohio State. Jeremy Cohen. And if you're interested for additional ones, I can give you others, but Douglas John Hall has been here at Holden often. His books are available here, and he's probably offered the most sophisticated attempt to examine the notion of stewardship. It's time for us to go to the Vespers. I've raised a number of issues here. These are not merely theoretical ones. When James Watt and Miguel Lujan reach the position of the Secretary of the Interior and use these arguments to justify certain policies, when the Norwegian pastors use it to justify the taking of mink whales, when the spotted owls are being debated in the old-growth forest, and this issue comes up, it's incumbent upon all Christians to think through how you understand this text and how you're going to use it. And even if you're going to say, just dismiss this text as a text, the larger issue of how we relate as Christians to the world which sustains us and of which we're a part is one we cannot escape. And as Gordon said, we have a tendency to think about sin and redemption, but we may be at that point, like at the Reformation, where we redefine what some of those terms mean and what the proper response is. Or maybe it's not that we redefine, but that God, working through the various things that are going around us, redefines it for us. Tomorrow I'm going to deal with a very depressing subject, which is the Christian attitude towards childbearing, contraception, and the like.